It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Various studies indicate that only about 20% of the adult population in the United States has an advance directive. So it's this provision that controls in the vast majority of situations. There is a pecking order in Virginia. Obviously, if it ever was the case, the doctor knows best, and we just turn to the physicians for decision-making, that day is long gone in Virginia. We have to find a decision-maker, and the law provides us the order for doing so.
Private attorney Nathan Kottkamp explains changes to the law of advance directives in the first of a two-part broadcast of a presentation given on April 26, 2010, at a conference on guardianship, elder rights and disability services sponsored by the Virginia Guardianship Association and the Virginia Elder Rights Coalition. And in this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn about a $686,000 jury verdict against a phony credit counselor and foreclosure rescue scammer. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 89, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. On May 27, President Obama canceled the proposed lease sale for exploratory oil drilling off Virginia's coast, putting it on hold for now. While it's still difficult to comprehend what the environmental and economic costs of the BP oil spill will be, the decision has many environmentalists cautiously optimistic. Marilyn Hyman, director of the Pew Environment Group's U.S. Arctic Program, says that no new oil leasing, exploration, or production should take place until the president's independent commission completes its process and reforms are implemented. J.R. Tolbert, advocate with Environment Virginia, says the president's decision is a step in the right direction and the disaster in the Gulf should be a huge wake-up call for the people of Virginia. Tolbert believes a permanent moratorium on offshore drilling is the only way to ensure a disaster such as the Gulf oil spill will never happen in Virginia's coastal waters. The Obama administration cited environmental concerns as well as concerns raised by the Department of Defense as reasons for the temporary moratorium. Governor Bob McDonnell does not support the decision. In other news, last month, Legal Services of Northern Virginia and the law firm of Surovell, Markle, Isaacs & Levy won a verdict of $686,000 in Fairfax County after a four-day jury trial for violations of the Virginia Consumer Protection Act and the Virginia Consumer Credit Counseling Act, fraud, and breach of fiduciary duty. The defendant was a phony credit counselor and foreclosure rescue scammer who claimed to be an attorney. He advised people to stop making mortgage and credit card payments, cease contact with their lenders, and charged upfront fees. He was a disbarred D.C. and California attorney, but never licensed in Virginia, and currently is under investigation by the FBI. In the legal aid case, the scammer bought the house back after it was foreclosed upon and entered a lease purchase agreement. He also scammed thousands of other homeowners in Northern Virginia by charging upfront fees. He then moved all his assets into a trust, but the lawsuit succeeded in reaching those assets as well. The case is titled, and we are not making this up, Hasina Ansari versus Howard Schmuckler, Fairfax County Circuit Court, case number CL-2009-8572. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answer to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. Before a tenant can get repairs done to rental housing, the tenant must do which two things? A. Be current in rent. B. Call the building inspector. Or C. Give written notice to the landlord. The correct answers are A. Be current in rent and C. Give written notice to the landlord. Tenants may, but do not have to, call the building inspector, but must be current in rent and give written notice to the landlord. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz. Is that legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
On April 26, 2010, private attorney Nathan Kottkamp spoke at a conference sponsored by the Virginia Guardianship Association and the Virginia Elder Rights Coalition on guardianship, elder rights, and disability services, about changes to the law of advanced directives, and the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there. Here's the first part of this two-part talk.
Keep in mind that Alzheimer's and dementia and some other conditions are progressive, or sometimes they're cyclical or they're episodic. And just because someone has that clinical diagnosis does not mean that they are necessarily incapable of making all their decisions yet. Maybe that they're incapable of making some, but not others. And that's another thing that we have provided expressly in the law is that physicians are able to determine, you know, let's say that decision-making is a complete spectrum, that an individual may be able to make certain slices out of that spectrum, but not the full scope. Frankly, I think it's probably difficult to imagine physicians being able to divide up those types of things, but we've given them the power to do that. So if that's ever an issue, just keep in mind that you can be capable of making some decisions, but not others. The capacity determination procedure, these determinations do need to be made in writing. They need to be placed in the patient's record, and they do need to be redetermined every 180 days. I will tell you, even in dealing with the hospitals that I hammer this home all the time, there is just an unbelievable amount of lack of documentation for this topic, and to the degree that you can ever, if you're ever involved in these situations, if you can just be asking, is it documented? That's just important. It protects everybody involved in the process. An attending physician and a second physician must make the determination that the patient's incapable of making informed decisions. There was a lot of consternation in 2009. People, for some reason, thought that we had added this second physician requirement, but it had been there for several years. We did make one tweak in 2009, which was to say that second physician needs to be someone that isn't involved in the clinical care of that patient. We want it to be an independent second judgment. I will also note that we had proposed some changes to expand the list of those that were able to make this determination in 2010, but those did not make it through. That would have included nurse practitioners and PAs and some others, right?
I think those were the two.
Maybe that was just those two. But those did not make it through, so it remains physicians and licensed clinical psychologists in Virginia. I will note that there is a new and potentially significant determination or change that we've made in 2010, and it's indicated there in the gray, and that is that the certification of a second physician or a licensed clinical psychologist is not required if a patient is unconscious or experiencing a profound impairment of consciousness due to trauma, stroke, or other acute physiological condition. And what this is designed to do is reduce the burden for facilities when you're dealing with someone, for example, who is in a coma. There's just no question that patient is not capable of making decisions. You don't need a second person to come into the bedside and actually make that determination. It is so blatantly obvious. We've added that in to make life easier, particularly for smaller providers, rural providers, where it's very difficult sometimes to get that second opinion in. So hopefully that'll be a real relief for a lot of facilities. One of the things that we did, and again, this is in response to comments and concerns out in the community, you'll see that it's Roman 3 there, is a notice provision. And this is a new addition in 2009. This may sound a little bit foolish to say that when you're making a determination that a patient is incapable of making informed decisions, that you have to provide notice to that patient. Well, inherently, notice to a patient that doesn't get it doesn't really mean anything. But nevertheless, it's in there as a patient protection. That notice is there so that if you make the determination and the patient sits bolt upright in their chair or their bed and say, "What are you talking about? I'm perfectly able to have a conversation with you about my healthcare wishes." You know, you may want to step back and reconsider your choice. But more importantly, in most situations, what this does is it makes sure that there's notice going out to the family or the agent. And what we were finding and what people were complaining about is a determination had been made and the family didn't know about it. And that's really a problem, and hopefully providers are honoring this new requirement. Another key change that we made, it's letter C on this, is that only one physician is required to make a determination that the patient has regained decision-making capacity. It takes two to determine that you don't have capacity, but we wanted to lower the threshold for situations in which, for example, those episodic situations, or the patient with dementia that has a great day and is now able to make decisions for themselves, we wanted to make sure that it was an easy process. It only takes one physician to make that determination. The exclusions and limitations of advanced directives, these are actually not new provisions. They're in italics primarily because they were relocated. We did some housekeeping in 2009, and so really this is just a relocated provision. But just to point out, if you don't have an advance directive, no presumption of what your wishes would be. No change to this. You can't use an advance directive for non-therapeutic sterilization, abortion, psychotherapy, psychosurgery. And the other thing that is very important to keep in mind, too, is that advance directives cannot override the existing provisions under the law with respect to involuntary admission or treatment. You can't have an advance directive that says, "I don't ever want to be admitted to a mental health facility, even if I am homicidal or suicidal." You can't do it. Those provisions under the law for TDOs and ECOs and these other mechanisms to be sure that patients and society are safe, they trump anything in an advance directive.
You're listening to a talk given on April 26, 2010, by private attorney Nathan Kottkamp about changes to the law of advance directives at a conference on guardianship, elder rights, and disability services sponsored by the Virginia Guardianship Association and the Virginia Elder Rights Coalition. We'll be back in a moment. If you're just joining us, the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show now rejoins private attorney Nathan Kottkamp in a talk about changes to the law of advance directives given on April 26, 2010 at a conference sponsored by the Virginia Guardianship Association and the Virginia Elder Rights Coalition on guardianship, elder rights, and disability services.
Suggested form of a written advance directive. You will find in the Virginia Code there is a suggested model form. We have taken some liberties, hopefully constructive and beneficial liberties to modify that, put it into a structure that we think is easier at least for people to follow. But keep in mind, it is only a suggested form. Even the model form that we've developed is not required, as I mentioned before. Advanced directives come in any shape, size that you wish. You can fill it out on a cocktail napkin for all I care, as long as, going back to what I mentioned earlier, your wishes in writing to adult witnesses, that's it. It is true that a notary is not required in Virginia for an advance directive. One of the things, and if it's not signed today or last week or something like that, it's going to be signed any moment now. One of the changes that happened with the General Assembly session from 2009 is that we've eliminated this requirement that wasn't really effective now anyway, but there was going to be a requirement that to put an advance directive in the soon-to-be operational, although I don't know when, advance directive registry in Virginia, you had to have your advance directive notarized, and they backed off on that requirement. So that's, I think that's, again, another blessing for all of us that are involved in this. It lowers the threshold. It makes it just that much easier for people to facilitate having their advance directives be recognized and get out there and get them to the hospitals and things. 2985 is the revocation of advance directive provision. One thing to keep in mind about advance directives is, as easy as it is to create an advance directive, it's actually even simpler to revoke it in Virginia. Assigned dated writing is all it takes, so you don't have to have it witnessed. Physical cancellation, this is physically destroying it, tearing it up, burning it, shredding it, whatever you want to do to physically undo it. And also oral revocation counts in Virginia. Now, the one change that we did make in 2009, again, this is primarily driven by our focus on mental health issues. You'll see when you look at the law, revocations need to be meaningful. You need to understand that you are revoking your advance directive, particularly if you're doing it physically. And the reason for this is there are patients with certain psychoses, there are dementia patients and others, who will do things like tear up every single sheet of paper in their room. They are not doing it because they are searching out their advance directive to revoke it, although maybe that would be the case. They're probably doing it because they've got some sort of mental condition. Their goal is not to revoke their advance directive, and so you need to look at the circumstances. If the person is tearing up every sheet of paper in the room saying, "Where's that advance directive? I want to revoke it," okay, that was their intention. But if they're just going nuts, that's probably not what they were trying to do. Injunction, court-ordered health care, no changes to the law here. You can still seek a court order. Any person can still petition the courts regarding health care if they wish. 2986, procedure in the absence of an advance directive, and I want to stress the importance of this provision, given that various studies indicate that only about 20% of the adult population in the United States has an advance directive. So it's this provision that controls in the vast majority of situations. There is a pecking order in Virginia. Obviously, if it ever was the case, the doctor knows best and we just turn to the physicians for decision-making, that day is long gone in Virginia. We have to find a decision-maker, and the law provides us the order for doing so. First, we look to see if a patient has a guardian. Obviously, very few patients in the general population have a guardian. You ought to know who these patients are because they ought to, one, be very obviously incapable of making decisions for themselves, and they ought to have court documents that appoint that guardian. Second in Virginia is a spouse. Luckily enough, in Virginia, you can only have one, so that makes things sort of simple. I would note that that with respect to legal separations and things like that, people oftentimes think that they are no longer spouses, even though they are still under the law. So if that is your situation or you know someone, keep in mind that you are still a spouse until the divorce filing has been made to the court. So a legal separation, you may still find your soon-to-be ex is making your decisions if you haven't laid out your choices. So word to the wise. The next set of categories, 3 through 6, you notice there's an asterisk there. And the importance of that asterisk is once we've gone past guardian and spouse, you enter into a zone where you're dealing with a class of people and you're dealing with the potential for multiple people within the same class to all have equal decision-making authority. And the law says we're supposed to turn and find what the majority would do. Well, that's very tough when there's only two. I will tell you from experience in on ethics committees that when there are three, there's still oftentimes not a majority. What you got is three different choices. Add fourth kid, makes it even worse. So, but just keep in mind that in any of these, there is no firstborn, there's no first son, you know, none of that stuff. It's everybody in the class has equal decision-making authority. And again, the pecking order is adult children, parents, then adult siblings, than any other blood relative. And then finally, again, what we changed in 2010 is that in the absence of all of those, we can now turn to an unrelated person who's demonstrating knowledge and interest in the care of a patient. And this can fall into many categories. This can be a same-sex partner that hasn't been named in an advance directive. This could be the loving neighbor that's been taking care of the octogenarian who has outlived the rest of her family. It can be any number of people. The one key limitation, and we probably should have put quotes here because I believe this is actually a direct quote out of the law.
It is.
But the key limitation to this category is it is not to be used for withholding or withdrawing life-prolonging procedures. In that situation, you got to go to court. For the record, we didn't want it that way. We wanted Virginia law to be consistent with many other states where you can have an unrelated person making these decisions, but that's part of the legislative process. We may be back with changes. We may not. I can't tell you. But just keep in mind that is a significant limitation to those decision-making authorities. And again, there is a note on spouses. Keep in mind that Virginia does not recognize same-sex unions, marriages, or anything else of the sort. So if that's you, if you know anyone, please be sure that those folks, so that they're not dealing with this issue with the life-prolonging procedure situation, name their partner in an advance directive so it's not an issue. You may have seen some of the news on April 15. It happened to be the day before National Healthcare Decisions Day. I hope that there's no coincidence there. But President Obama issued a memorandum to HHS to work up some rules with respect to visitation rights of same-sex couples and others that are related. Certain religious orders and things like that have this implication as well. And there's a request in there to be sure that HHS develops regulations to be sure that advance directives are honored by same-sex couples as well. So we may see some federal requirements on this that may affect how Virginia law ultimately gets rolled out.
You've been listening to the first of a two-part talk given on April 26, 2010 by private attorney Nathan Kottkamp about changes to the law of advance directives at a conference on guardianship, elder rights, and disability services sponsored by the Virginia Guardianship Association and the Virginia Elder Rights Coalition. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a free copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on Your Legal Rights and Responsibilities. Here's this week's question. Medicaid benefits, a government health insurance, are available to which two groups of low-income people? A, the elderly. B, people who are temporarily or permanently disabled, or C, children, their caretakers, and pregnant women. If you know the two correct answers,
email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1210 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegebright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. For nearly two decades, all adults in Virginia have had the right to make their health care wishes known in documents, in which they explain the health care they do or don't want if they later can't make their own decisions. Join us next week when private attorney Nathan Kottkamp explains changes to the law of advance directives in the second of a two-part presentation. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegebright.